where you have instability and you have poverty and you have pain, you have a fertile breeding ground for fundamentalist ideologies.
When you're talking about terrorism, you have to have cooperation.
Scan the headlines. Listen to the news. Threats to global security are seemingly everywhere, and that means they hit hard here at home. So what can we do to defuse threats that once seemed distant but now play a prominent role in our daily lives?
This is when we need to think globally and act locally.
You cannot have development without security, and you cannot have security without development.
We are not an island. Our oceans do not protect us as they once did.
I'm David Brancaccio. Join me this hour for Security Check, Confronting Today's Global Threats, from the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio.
We cannot escape the fact that we are all connected.
More after this. I'm David Brancaccio, and you're listening to the Public Radio special, Security Check, Confronting Today's Global Threats.
Boarding passes in hand, folks.
Security in America has taken on a whole new meaning since 9/11. Metal detectors aren't just for airports anymore. Some of us have to pass through them these days just to get to the office. And American military forces are involved in what the government calls a global war on terror.
Everything metal, take it off. If you have a laptop or computer, take it out, place it in the bin by itself.
But are we any safer? Is safety even attainable? We know that people, goods, and money move more freely around the world than ever before. But so do diseases, weapons, drugs, and other security threats. Look closely at any one of these threats, and you start to see how they're connected to the others. Diseases with poverty, poverty with terrorism, terrorism with organized crime, and distant wars with our own security here at home. If the threats are all connected, which do we tackle first? If national borders can't contain them, whose job is it to take them on? And call it selfish or call it practical. But what does it all mean for us?
This is a special announcement. For security reasons, please keep your luggage and all packages with you at all times until they are checked.
Procedures like this at airports are part of a web of security most Americans take for granted. For the most part, police departments, fire stations, hospital emergency rooms, and more form a comforting backstop to our daily lives. But what if you live somewhere where all sense of safety and security was shattered, where everyday services like calling 911 to summon a paramedic are the stuff of fantasy? Northern Uganda is just one of the many places around the world fitting this description. Winston Churchill once described this East African nation as the pearl of Africa, and the luster still exists in parts of Uganda. The country's economic success is hailed as a model for the whole continent. But northern Uganda has been at war for decades, and the country as a whole is practically surrounded by armed conflict. Uganda's main rebel group, the Lord's Resistance Army, is particularly vicious. Known as the LRA, they say they want to establish a government based on the Bible's Ten Commandments. But these guys are best known for abducting and brutally maiming tens of thousands of children. Correspondent Kristen McHugh reports from Uganda on how this war and others like it around the world pose a security risk for all of us.
Bujagali Falls, not far from the source of the Nile River in southeastern Uganda, is one of the country's stunning tourist attractions. On any given day, members of the Bundando cultural group enthusiastically entertain passing Westerners. But it is their backdrop, a series of small crashing waterfalls as the Nile rushes downstream, that draws people to this location. These near-deafening, foam-capped waves are beautiful, but their violent movement is also symbolic of Uganda's recent political history.
Uganda is sort of divided nicely in half. The southern part is very well developed, economically and otherwise, whereas the north isn't.
Stella Sabidi is executive director of the Center for Conflict Resolution, a Ugandan non-governmental agency based in the country's capital, Kampala.
We've lost, I think, a whole generation in the north because children have grown up in violence, seeing nothing but violence. They don't know what peace means.
These are just a few of the children of the lost generation. They live in the Bobi camp for residents displaced by Uganda's 19-year civil war, against the Lord's Resistance Army, a cult-like organization that has spent the past two decades seeking the violent imposition of a new government in Uganda that would rule based upon an orthodox interpretation of the Bible's Ten Commandments. Located 16 miles south of the city of Gulu, this squalid, congested camp of compact mud and thatched huts is home to more than 18,000 people. Bobi is one of hundreds of displacement camps in northern Uganda.
In percentage terms, I would say just over 90% of Gulu population is displaced. Typical percentage for most of northern Uganda.
Andrew Timpson heads the UN's Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs for northern Uganda's Gulu district.
I was speaking to a man here a few months ago who pointed his house out to me, which is all of 300 meters from this camp. He told me that he did not feel safe to stay there, to live in that house, and that gives you a sense of the fear.
I'm standing near the perimeter of the Bobi camp. I'm standing near the river. This is the river that is very important to this camp. It's where they get their water. It's where they wash their clothes. It's where the children come to cool off. You can hear right now there are a number of children in the river splashing around, having a good time. But the river is important, especially in the rainy season, because just across is the bush where rebels hide. Residents of this camp will not go beyond this river for fear that they will be kidnapped by the rebels.
You have to imagine a refugee camp and then try and make it 10 times as bad. So keeping these people alive is the biggest activity. That said, we've also got 230,000 refugees from Sudan, Congo, and still some from Rwanda in Uganda.
Ken Davies is the United Nations World Food Program Director in Uganda.
Where you have instability and you have poverty and you have pain, you have a fertile breeding ground for fundamentalist and radical ideologies. And remember that Osama bin Laden was in Sudan before he went to Afghanistan. So, yes, absolutely, this whole terrorist thread affects the neighboring countries, and it grows and it spreads.
Civil war in this part of Africa has indeed grown and spread, spilling over international borders along the way. The Lord's Resistance Army, for example, until recently, had a safe haven in neighboring Sudan. From there, aid agencies say the LRA was able to abduct as many as 30,000 Ugandans, many of them children.
I fear being abducted by the rebels, so they commanded that whoever they find, they are going to kill.
15-year-old Akello is what humanitarian groups refer to as a night commuter. Fear of abductions and LRA attacks drive thousands of children to seek refuge each night in hospitals, schools, and other town centers throughout northern Uganda. Akello has been a night commuter for 3 years. On this night, Akello trekked nearly 5 miles from her home to join nearly 1,000 others at this facility for night commuters, known as Noah's Ark, in the center of Gulu. Surrounded by a tall razor wire fence, the children here sleep on concrete slabs under tattered blankets.
When I was abducted, I was taken to an LRA camp near Gulu for 1 month before being taken to Sudan.
The children sleeping at Noah's Ark are doing so in order to escape the fate of this 13-year-old boy, whom we've agreed not to name in order to protect his identity. Wearing a pale yellow t-shirt, he tells me he was kidnapped at age 9.
I was taught how to assemble and dismantle a gun, an AK-47. I was responsible for one magazine of bullets.
The boy recently escaped his captors and is now a resident at the Gulu Support the Children organization, or GUSCO. Funded in part by the United States, GUSCO helps children transition back to a life free of the LRA. Residents receive basic medical care and counseling. Classes include hygiene, life skills, and English.
Today we are in a place called Olwa, an internally displaced people's camp in Gulu district.
Grace Akello is the Minister of State for Northern Uganda. Wearing small wire-rimmed glasses, traditional African dress, and modern hiking boots, it is clear she is on a mission as she arrives with dozens of well-armed military escorts at this camp 18 miles west of Gulu on a hot, dusty afternoon.
I'm here to talk to the people about peace and reconstruction, rehabilitation, which is my main mandate.
The reason I say I am bringing peace.
After nearly 20 years of war and countless broken ceasefires, longtime observers of this conflict say Akello's enthusiasm is well-founded. Last year's peace agreement in southern Sudan raises the prospects for stability in northern Uganda as well. This is good news for East Africa and America. Uganda received well over $200 million in U.S. aid in 2004, making it one of the largest U.S. aid recipients in all of Africa. While much of the money pays for humanitarian programs, a portion of the American aid funds Uganda's participation in the East African Counterterrorism Initiative. This program, announced by President Bush 2 years ago, encourages East African governments to work together to identify terrorist cross-border movements.
Insecurity and conflict on one side of an international border certainly breeds insecurity on the other side of the border. And what you have seen in northern Uganda is a consequence.
Even if a peace accord is finally reached in northern Uganda, the World Food Program's Ken Davies argues it will take global generosity to bring a lasting peace to this troubled country.
When you have development and you have peace and you have progress, people are content the way their lives are moving, and they are not going to be prone to join fundamentalist and terrorist organizations.
On the traffic-clogged streets of Kampala, it is hard to imagine that less than 200 miles north, Uganda is a country at war. Paved roads, modern stores, and upscale homes are obvious signs of development and progress here. Stella Sabidi believes finding ways to spread Kampala's progress will ultimately benefit the children of northern Uganda, the region, and the world.
Someone doesn't go to bed feeling very happy and comfortable, well-fed, and is not worried, and then in the morning he or she gets up and picks up a gun and goes to kill people. It just doesn't happen like that.
For Security Check, I'm Kristen McHugh, Gulu, northern Uganda.
So how does civil war in Uganda, or in any other faraway spot for that matter, connect with other global security challenges and our own safety here at home?
There's a very obvious connection that when you have a conflict, it can be extremely damaging to an economy.
McCartan Humphreys, a professor of political science at Columbia University, says the connections don't stop there.
And the problem with that is that that can lead to a vicious circle. You get poor, you have more conflict, you get poor, you get more conflict.
Poverty and lack of development seem to go hand in hand with civil war, and experts are just beginning to understand how this connection works. Julia Taft, a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, recently retired from the United Nations Development Program.
Development is the investment in helping communities have better health, improving school, improving democracy, and reducing corruption and promoting good governance. If we don't do development, then there is a prospect for political disaffection, but also transnational threats.
Beyond poverty and development, civil war is also connected to global security threats because it spreads. In Central America, the Balkans, East Asia, and across Africa, we see examples of how neighbors get drawn in to domestic conflicts.
In general, what you can see in this whole region is an interrelated set of conflicts.
Kieran Donnelly heads the International Rescue Committee efforts in Uganda.
We have a significant conflict ongoing in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, in which Uganda has played a large role historically, although officially Ugandan troops have withdrawn from Congo at this point. You have the Southern Sudan problem, which is very key to American foreign policy interests.
So, civil war tends to spread, and it leaves a wake of poverty and despair. Without sounding too egocentric, U.S.-centric, or any other-centric, it is still fair to ask, how does this affect us here at home? Or, to be blunt, why should Americans care?
Countries, particularly when they result in failed states, can serve as a breeding ground of some form for terrorism.
Again, Professor Humphreys.
It's uncontrolled areas in which flows of illicit funds are more easily achieved, in which people can train and so on.
The Ugandans have been good partners with us in fighting terrorism.
Jimmy Colker is the American ambassador to Uganda. He sees clearly how Uganda's problems connect with the United States and the rest of the world.
Lord's Resistance Army has killed more people than any other terrorist group active in the world today, more than Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah.
If civil war in Africa is truly a security threat to the whole world, U.S. Ambassador Kolker says the nations of the world need to face that threat together.
This is one where you need to think globally and act locally. I think all of us have learned from all sorts of experience that no one's alone in this. There's no sense that, well, this is a problem only for Ugandans to worry about.
This is not just a question of global solidarity. It's a question of enlightened self-interest.
Bob Orr, an American, is UN Assistant Secretary General for Strategic Planning.
For a country like the United States that has real legitimate security concerns in the realm of terrorism, in the realm of organized crime and drugs, the realm of proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, every single one of these threats has a base both inside the United States and outside the United States. We are not an island. Our oceans do not protect us as they once did.
You're listening to Security Check, Confronting Today's Global Threats, from the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio. For more information, visit our website at globalsecuritycheck.org. Coming up, finding answers to other international security challenges like organized crime, the AIDS pandemic, and arms trafficking. I'm David Brancaccio. More after this. I'm David Brancaccio, and you're listening to the public radio special, Security Check, Confronting Today's Global Threats.
The basic and probably foremost responsibility for Customs and Border Protection is the prevention of terrorists and their weapons from entering the United States.
Christopher Hess at Washington's Dulles Airport works hard to spot trouble among the airport's 2.5 million visitors and the 5 million pieces of luggage coming through baggage carousels like this every year. Trouble can come in many forms, but what if, and it's not a pleasant hypothetical, but what if one of these bags contains some highly enriched uranium or some of the other ingredients needed to make a small but potentially deadly nuclear device? How many times has one of your bags been scanned with a Geiger counter? A catchy phrase for this scourge is loose nukes, radiological components that experts worry are rattling around the world, ready to be sold by criminals to organized terror groups. As correspondent Simon Marks reports from Moscow, the threat of nuclear material on the loose is clear, but how to rein it in is clearly not.
This is a sound you would not have been able to hear just 15 years ago. Not because it didn't exist, but because it was reserved for a handful of select ears. It is the peaceful hum of a Russian nuclear reactor located at the Kurchatov Institute in the northwest of Moscow.
It's an institute where the U.S. Department of Energy first began doing upgrades of nuclear facilities, and they have several facilities at the Kurchatov Institute.
Robert Burles worries about the Kurchatov Institute. He directs the Moscow office of the non-governmental Nuclear Threat Initiative, an organization jointly founded by businessman Ted Turner and former Democratic Party Senator Sam Nunn.
It's a relatively open facility, and a group of terrorists could very easily break into that facility if they tried hard enough.
Visitors to the Kurchatov Institute are today treated to a grand display of security. Special forces are put through their paces in a troop carrier converted to monitor levels of radioactive contamination. A corporate video has also been produced, designed to set mines at rest.
This is the sound of the protection system being activated in the case of an emergency situation in the reactor. Fortunately, this is only a simulation of the danger, but we never know.
But what we do know is that terrorists have at least discussed the possibility of launching an attack against the Kurchatov Institute. On the 26th of October 2002, Russian troops stormed the Dubrovka Theatre in Moscow to end a siege by fighters from the breakaway Russian region of Chechnya, who held 900 theatre-goers and performers hostage. The Russians pumped a still unidentified narcotic gas into the theatre, killing the Chechen hostage-takers, but also 129 of their captives. While that very public military operation was underway, over at the Kurchatov Institute, the Russians were also busy, quietly upgrading security.
Had we not been concerned at that time that terrorists might target the Kurchatov Institute, we would be irresponsible, right?
Sergei Lavrov is Russia's foreign minister. In an interview, he confirmed that the Kremlin received clear indications that the group that seized the theatre also debated attacking the Kurchatov.
All these sites are under extra protection. For obvious reasons, I cannot go into the details.
A series of terrorist incidents in Russia underscored the possibility of an attack on a nuclear facility, and the Russian authorities concluded that if fighters from Chechnya or others pursuing a cause are sufficiently desperate to lay siege to a theatre in Moscow or a school in southern Russia, they would probably also be willing to attack, raid or besiege a nuclear site. Alexander Pikayev of Moscow's Institute of World Economy has written extensively on the problems securing and safeguarding Russia's nuclear arsenal.
We cannot say, well, 50% is okay, situation in 99% of facilities is okay, because even if in one facility, which contains probably less than 1% of the dangerous nuclear materials, the amount of that nuclear materials might be enough to make a nuclear bomb.
Both the US and Russian governments have been only too happy to invite reporters to witness the dismantling of their nuclear stockpile. Missiles are broken apart, the fissile material is recovered, and then their parts are melted down for scrap. A US congressional initiative headed by Republican Senator Richard Lugar and his Democratic colleague, former Senator Sam Nunn, deactivated 312 Russian nuclear warheads in 2004 alone. It sounds impressive, but, warns Russian military analyst Pavel Felgenhauer, it can create a raft of new problems to resolve.
Decommissioning means that they're dismantled, but the material that they were composed of didn't disappear. That means it's stored somewhere. Moskvaku is stored in much less secure conditions than it was when it was a nuclear warhead. It's not an easy situation, and it's made worse by ambiguity in how, in which direction will the Russian-American relations develop.
And the U.S.-Russia relationship, already in trouble over President Vladimir Putin's rollback of democratic reform in his country, has not been plain sailing when it comes to the issue of securing Russia's nuclear stockpile. The Russian defense minister told an audience in New York earlier this year that Western concerns about Russian nuclear materials falling into the hands of criminals were pure fiction. But CIA Director Porter Goss testified before the U.S. Congress that enough nuclear materials have already disappeared from Russian custody to build a nuclear bomb. And the former U.S. Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham also offers an assessment starkly at odds with Russian claims.
In addition, Russia must work harder to address vulnerabilities at their nuclear and radiological facilities. At a time when terrorists are known to be scouting under secured locations worldwide, we're still working to gain access to some of these facilities in Russia that, in my judgment, need to be addressed sooner than later.
The Dubrovka Theatre Complex, scene of the October 2002 siege, has now reopened. Dance classes are offered to young Muscovites, music ringing through a place that would otherwise echo with the silence of death. Dance teacher Marina Maratova says most families she encounters don't spend their time worrying about the prospect of Russia's enemies going nuclear.
I am not afraid that terrorists will be able to take over nuclear sites. Our interior forces are doing all they can to fight them.
But Robert Burles of the Nuclear Threat Initiative's Moscow office argues there is no reason or time for complacency.
The terrorists are not going to wait. It must be a government priority, a very high government priority. It must also become a high priority for other members of the G8, as well as other nuclear powers and other concerned countries. There's a lot that can be done. It just requires the leadership to make it happen.
Global leadership, he says, is the key to securing Moscow's arsenal and neutralizing the threat so-called loose nukes pose to the security of Russia and the wider world. For Security Check, I'm Simon Marks, Moscow, Russia.
How then can global leadership be better harnessed to deal with the enormous threats posed by the spread of nuclear material and weapons?
If it wasn't for Pakistan, there wouldn't be an Iranian nuclear program. If it wasn't for Pakistan, Libya never would have gotten centrifuges. If it wasn't for Pakistan, it's unlikely that North Korea would have gotten whatever centrifuge equipment they have.
Joseph Cirincione argues that principles need to trump politics when governments make decisions. He's the director of nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, and he faults the Bush White House for failing to hold Pakistan to account for the proliferation activities of AQ Khan. The architect of Pakistan's nuclear program was also selling nuclear secrets all over the world.
Clearly, the administration decided that they needed Pakistan's support in the hunt for Osama bin Laden more than they needed Pakistan's support in shutting down this proliferation network.
Organized crime is one of the most efficient transmission mechanisms of threats around the world.
Bob Orr, UN Assistant Secretary General for Strategic Planning, says in addition to proliferators like AQ Khan, the world's governments must also be on guard against the growing tentacles of organized crime in this arena.
Whether you're talking about the movement of arms, of fissile material for nuclear devices, organized crime provides transmission mechanism. If we don't deal with this fundamental reality and look at organized crime as an enabler for all of the things we're trying to stop, we won't get to the fundamentals.
Selena Reaglio spends her time trying to deal with that fundamental reality. The director of counterterrorism finance programs at the U.S. State Department, it is her job to track down and shut down the financial operations that can support this traffic.
It really has to do with the profit. As opposed to terrorists who are really motivated by ideology, we take a look at money as the oxygen that actually promotes proliferation in terms of it makes it much harder for them to move the money, or they can't actually physically transfer the money, the actual transfer of the material will not take place.
Since the attacks of September the 11th, the U.S. government, acting in concert with other countries, has frozen bank accounts, prosecuted rogue financial institutions, and made it harder for criminals to launder or park their money in offshore tax havens. Selena Reaglio argues that a coordinated global response is key to success.
All of the signatories to the UN are required to actually criminalize terrorist financing and terrorism as a result of the 9/11 attacks under the UN Security Council Resolution 1373. So this is something that actually the entire world community has recognized as a problem, and more importantly, there are actually measures being taken to address it.
And Joseph Cirincione at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace says forcefully carrying out these measures is key to keeping nuclear capability out of the wrong hands.
Osama bin Laden, according to the 9/11 report, for example, spent $1.5 million buying what he thought was highly enriched uranium. Turned out to be radioactive junk. We're in a race to secure this material before they can get their hands on it.
Since September 11th, the government has put much more emphasis on tracking who is entering the United States.
You're all set. Welcome to the United States.
Visitors like this can carry a lot of things with them, including disease. And officials from U.S. Customs and Border Protection have the job of stopping that as well.
To help prevent the introduction of foot and mouth disease into
the world is beginning to understand how disease connects with global security. Epidemics can destabilize governments. A poor medical infrastructure can allow minor health issues to become major outbreaks. Easily preventable diseases thrive during war. And the immunizations and vaccines we all take for granted become low priorities for hungry families seeking basic shelter. Meanwhile, every infectious disease in the world is just a plane ride away from our hometowns. Roxana Saberi reports from Thailand on efforts to slow the spread of one global security threat. This one is called AIDS.
Hello, goodbye.
With a bit of English and an array of short skirts, Pattaya's red light district attracts its share of Thais and foreigners.
Go and go lesbian show, ping pong show.
This in-your-face sex industry is splashed across the beach resort town, around 90 miles southeast of Bangkok. Still, sex workers here and across the country have been trying to repair their reputation, to shed their image as a one-stop shop for AIDS. In the late 1980s, Thailand emerged as one of the epicenters for the growing HIV/AIDS pandemic. From 1991 to 2003, Thailand's annual rate of new HIV infections dropped from its peak of 143,000 to around 19,000. Patrick Brenny, the UN AIDS coordinator for Thailand, says the decline was largely due to increased use of condoms and reduced brothel visits.
The trend of the epidemic in Thailand, again, 10 years ago, when there was a very successful response to the epidemic, there was a large level of political mobilization, there was effective prevention in terms of the use of condoms in brothels, the famous 100% condom program.
Thailand's Ministry of Public Health says it realizes the country can't afford to become complacent. It's helped put on programs like this AIDS awareness concert on Valentine's Day. The ministry spokeswoman, Nitya Chandrang Mahabol, says her government is well aware that a health crisis in one country can be a threat to other countries as well. She says last year, Thailand donated 1 million condoms to neighboring Burma.
We think that what's happening in their own soil can be happening in Thailand as well.
In his air-conditioned office off a busy street in Rayong, Borapad Damnom looks like the picture of perfect health.
Yeah, cocktails, so cocktail.
But Borapad's routine of downing 4 antiretroviral pills a day reveals a portrait of the changing faces of Thailand's AIDS victims.
I learned that I was infected with HIV in 1993 after my wife delivered our second baby. Later on, our baby died in only 3 months. I was wondering about this. I had a blood test. The result was HIV positive.
Patrick Brenny says Borapat's story shows Thailand is still vulnerable to a resurgence of the epidemic, this time spreading beyond sex workers and their clients.
The difficulty with the epidemic now is that it's basically matured into the population, and so most of the people being infected today are housewives, are the partners of those who used to go to sex workers.
Across Asia, national HIV infections are low compared to Africa. But because Asia is so populated, even low national HIV prevalence means large numbers of people living with the virus. If Thailand and its neighbors falter, the impact would be far-reaching, a risk Washington does not want to take.
We can go in and we'll actually take a look at the vaccine.
In Rayong and Chonburi, two provinces with some of the highest incidence rates of HIV in Thailand, the U.S. government is helping conduct the largest trial of any AIDS vaccine in the world. Bruce Merrill of the Armed Forces Research Institute oversees the project's vaccine storage.
We have both of our vaccines. They are stored here like this.
Thousands of 18 to 30-year-olds have volunteered to get injections of a combination AIDS vaccine over 3.5 years. Critics say the test is a waste of time and money because one of the two vaccines failed in previous human tests in the U.S. But a sense of urgency is spurring on supporters of the project. Around 70 Thais are infected by the virus every day. Organizers say even a partially effective vaccine, reducing the average rate of HIV infection by half, would be a victory. At a bustling weekend market in Bangkok, it's not hard to find a sample of the global community. The CIA has warned infectious diseases such as HIV/AIDS put American tourists, workers, and soldiers abroad at risk. In response to this threat, President Bush launched his emergency plan for AIDS relief in 2003 to increase spending on HIV/AIDS around the world. Dr. Jordan Topperow, the director of the U.S. Center for Disease Control in Thailand, says the U.S. realizes HIV in Thailand also poses a threat to Americans.
If 50% of Americans were going to have a life-threatening illness over the next decade, would we consider that a catastrophe? Would we consider that a crisis? I don't know of anyone who would answer that question, no.
At a Buddhist temple in Bangkok, Thais toss coins into a row of metal pots, wishing for happiness and health. As miles away, Borapot wishes to replace despair with hope. He has opened his own non-governmental organization, and he hopes countries, including the U.S., will continue to support programs that make expensive AIDS drugs more affordable to the developing world. For Security Check, I'm Roxana Saberi, Bangkok, Thailand.
The scourge of infectious disease can have both very local and very far-reaching implications.
There is good globalization and there is bad globalization.
Jan Eliasson is the ambassador of Sweden to the United States and president-elect of the UN General Assembly.
If you, for instance, have a disease, SARS, in Asia, or if you can even imagine a smallpox breaking out, either independently or by terrorists, then you have a huge disaster with an enormous movement of people around the world. The fact that we are on one planet makes us truly interdependent, and that means that a problem for one is a problem for all.
No country, whether it's the United States, Europe, North Asia, is safe if the national health systems in other regions of the world can't cope with the infectious disease in those regions.
Because of this, infectious disease is beginning to be seen as something more than a local healthcare issue. The UN's Bob Orr recently helped draw up a list of recommendations for Kofi Annan, which included infectious disease as a very real global security threat.
Because our threats are now universal, our collective action needs to be universal. This is what's new. It's not just a small alliance of countries that can build a NATO to protect and enhance security. That mechanism is still useful and needed. But now the kinds of threats, the non-state actors, the terrorism, HIV/AIDS, these kind of threats are universal. You can't use an alliance to stop that unless it's an alliance of every country in the world.
You're listening to Security Check, Confronting Today's Global Threats, from the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio. For more information, visit our website at globalsecuritycheck.org. Coming up, how small weapons may pose a larger threat to world peace than you think. And our one-on-one interview with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. I'm David Brancaccio. More after this. I'm David Brancaccio, and you're listening to the public radio special, Security Check, Confronting Today's Global Threats.
This is our little rover command center. We don't really use it for observation that much now. We like to have people actually out on the floor. It's a little more effective, but we do keep our dogs here. But again, it's a lot easier if we have people on the floor, our rovers, that can actually do cold stops of passengers if needed to ask questions about their baggage.
The day-to-day work of security officials at Washington Dulles Airport is filled with watching for contraband like drugs and weapons. The trafficking of these and other items has an important connection to threats to global security. These weapons fuel conflict, and the profits fuel just about everything else. Nowhere is this more clear than in Colombia, where criminal gangs, left-wing guerrillas, and right-wing paramilitaries have smuggled tens of millions of dollars of dangerous weapons. As Reese Ehrlich reports, these weapons not only threaten Colombia's stability, but the stability of nearby countries and the United States. He begins the story on a police patrol riding through the mean streets of Bogota.
Vamos, tomemos la avenida Primero de Mayo.
Sergeant Gabriel Ochoa jumps into a pickup truck with four other Bogota police officers for their nightly patrol. They're looking for criminals, especially those carrying illegal small arms. Sergeant Ochoa says that legally, only people who get permits from the Ministry of Defense are allowed to own handguns, shotguns, and rifles. But the reality is far different.
Although we have strict gun control here in Colombia, people can easily get small arms on the black market.
The country is awash in small arms, and the results are clearly on display during a visit to a Bogota hospital.
It was about 11:30 in the morning at my place. My friend opened the door, and suddenly this guy took out a pistol and started to shoot.
This young man, who didn't want us to use his name, says he was recently shot after some old enemies showed up on his doorstep, brandishing pistols acquired on the black market.
The owner of the house tried to defend me, so the guy killed him. He shot me in the shoulder. The entire country is covered with arms. I've made the effort to get away from the world of guns, but it's a problem for the whole country.
There are an estimated 3 million illegal small arms in this country of 43 million people. Most weapons are imported by drug cartels and political insurgents, and the guns are frequently traded for cocaine. Colombia's Minister of Defense, Jorge Uribe, says this arms and cocaine racket is not only a problem for Colombia, but a security threat for Latin America and the United States.
Every time an American goes into that trip that comes after sniffing some drugs, they should think a little bit, where is that coming from, and how many lives have been lost in the process of bringing that pleasure. The color of cocaine is white, but really is red because the amount of blood.
In 2000, the U.S. initiated Plan Colombia, a program to stop cocaine trafficking and, in part, arms smuggling. So far, the United States has paid $3.5 billion for Plan Colombia, the third highest amount of foreign aid given to any country in the world.
We are in the area of Santa Fe de Rialto right now. It's a very small village about 200 miles northwest of Bogota. It's the birthplace of the AUC, the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia.
The AUC is the umbrella group for Colombia's right-wing paramilitaries. They are the anti-communist organizations originally created by landowners and drug traffickers to combat a left-wing guerrilla insurgency, which began 40 years ago and has plagued successive governments ever since. AUC soldiers in this compound openly carry assault rifles and sidearms. The paramilitaries are infamous arms smugglers. In a 2001 incident, according to a Colombian government indictment, the AUC brought in 3,000 AK-47s and 5 million rounds of ammunition aboard a ship supposedly carrying soccer balls. A large amount of Colombia's small arms come through Central America. Some are U.S.-supplied weapons originally given to the Contras in Nicaragua in the 1980s. Julian Bolivar is chief negotiator for the AUC.
At first, we used our own arms to defend ourselves from the guerrillas. Later, we got M60 machine guns and mortars. Some of the Central American arms went through three wars before they got here.
The AUC paramilitaries are now in the process of demobilizing and handing their arms over to the government. All 15,000 to 20,000 paramilitaries are supposed to be disarmed by the end of 2005. Antonio Navarro, a leftist member of the Colombian Senate, says the AUC is keeping some of its arms in order to maintain control of drugs and gambling in some cities.
Their goal is not to give the arms back or really to stop fighting. The paramilitaries are actually drug dealers. So if they have these ways of exporting cocaine, they also have ways of importing illegal arms.
While the confiscated weapons are turned over to Indumil, the state-owned arms manufacturer, several government sources claim the military and police reuse some of the confiscated arms. Alfredo Rangel is director of the Security and Democracy Foundation, a prestigious centrist think tank. He says some confiscated weapons may go back into circulation.
I'm afraid there's not enough control over those arms. They could end up on the black market and end up rearming the paramilitaries or the guerrillas.
When contacted for a response, the Ministry of Defense did not return phone calls nor explain exactly how the confiscated arms are destroyed.
Monsieur le capitaine? Si, monsieur le capitaine?
Back on the mean streets of Bogota, the shooting victim I met in the Bogota hospital says doctors expect him to make a full recovery.
I was planning to study to be an electrician. At the moment, I don't know what's going to happen.
Cases like these are less common these days because the government of President Alvaro Uribe has significantly reduced common crime. Yet an estimated 400,000 illegal arms enter the country every year. That's because the arms trade is driven by large-scale criminal gangs and political violence, not small-time crooks. Experts say the small arms trade will likely continue as long as Colombia produces cocaine and political insurgency. General Manuel Bonet is a former head of Colombia's armed forces.
The arms trafficking is well beyond government control. There are many international interests in that. The problem in Colombia is the conflict. The only manner to control the trafficking of the weapon is to reduce the conflict.
For security check, I'm Reese Ehrlich, Bogota, Colombia.
Para 75,082,961.
In the Colombia conflict, there are clearly those who are benefiting from the trade in illicit drugs.
For Professor McCartan Humphreys, the connection between war and illegal trafficking is clear.
They cannot continue their trade if there's a resolution of the conflict. So they need a conflict in order for that trade to persist.
Whether you're a terrorist or a drug runner or a person who's actually trafficking in humans, you actually use the same techniques, whether it's trying to get false documentation and passports or, more importantly, trying to figure out how to channel money.
Selena Rialio of the U.S. State Department draws the final connection between war, trafficking, and global security.
Whether you're a terrorist or a Colombian drug lord, who can provide you with these types of services? And if you think about that, these are the ways that the terrorists are trying to come into the United States and how to actually fund their operations.
The State Department has recognized the only way to tackle the problem is through a global strategy.
When we do a public designation of a group, let's say the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, you really want to be able to shut down all of their operations financially around the world.
None of us has been as sensitive to these fantastically complex interconnections as we need to be, and something we all need to work on, in my opinion.
Jean Kirkpatrick was U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations in the Reagan administration.
Collective action is very complex, too. You know, it's not just collective, it's complicated. I think that we need to face those interconnections and those problems in a lot of different ways.
When you're talking about terrorism, you have to have cooperation. When you're talking about narcotics trafficking, when you're talking about weapons of mass destruction, you're talking about the need for states to have control systems all around the world because of the ease of transmission of this stuff.
UN Secretary General Annan recently commissioned a report from a Blue Ribbon panel to look carefully at global threats and how the world, including the United Nations, needs to deal with those threats. Gareth Evans was on the panel. He found plenty to criticize.
The United Nations is nothing very much more than the combination of the members that make it up. It's no good, those of us who like and clamour for multilateral system improvement, to say that what we've got is the best of all possible worlds. It isn't.
Throughout our program, we've discussed how the major security challenges facing the world today are linked to one another in important ways. The drug trade in Colombia fuels the arms trade. The arms trade fuels conflicts. Conflicts lead to failed states and terrorist breeding grounds. Organized crime feeds off of trafficking of all kinds, including nuclear material. Infectious disease thrives in conflicts and slows economic development, which leads to conflict and terrorism, and so the cycle continues. But there must be answers. Many of our experts today explained that if these global challenges have no respect for international borders, then our responses must also go way beyond individual countries and small alliances. Global problems need global solutions. Unfortunately, the world doesn't have much of a track record pulling off these global solutions. We took this dilemma right up the chain of command to Kofi Annan, Secretary General of the United Nations.
Like all organizations, institutions, government, corporations, we've had our problems, but we've also had our share of successes.
Annan is acutely aware of the scandals dogging the United Nations and accepts his share of responsibility.
I think the UN needs to adapt. It needs to improve. We need to strengthen our management. We need to be much more transparent. And we need to be able to restructure and adapt ourselves to face the challenges of today. And I think the proposals I have put before the members for reform will help us move forward in that direction.
The Secretary General is actively promoting the concept that the threats facing the world are highly interconnected.
The report I've put before the member states makes it quite clear that there is a link between development and security. You cannot have development without security, and you cannot have security without development. And all this should be embedded on the respect for human rights and the rule of law. So it all hangs together, and we all need to cooperate to make it happen.
Significant change at the United Nations is almost impossible without American cooperation, and Annan is confident that the U.S. is on board.
I think the United States has a natural leadership in this organization, and their involvement and cooperation on the reform proposal is extremely important. I have spoken to President Bush since my report came out, and also Secretary of State Rice, and they have both indicated to me that they will support and work with me on the reform. Obviously, they don't accept everything in the report, but there are lots of good things in the report that we can all embrace. So I'm looking forward to working with them.
Next, come on through. Thank you, sir. Have a nice flight.
A while back, I was hanging out with some ranchers in a piece of the Mojave Desert in Arizona. They were rough and ready, these ranchers, and the topic around the dinner table one night was security of sorts. These ranchers were worried about some survivalist types they'd run into up the road. The survivalists, they said, were dug in with enough camouflage gear, GPS direction finders, and freeze-dried beef stroganoff to secure themselves against who knows what for a long time. The ranchers didn't like the looks of them. "You gotta worry about the right things," one of my rancher friends said. With that, he got up from the table to eliminate what turned out to be a big old snake that he heard rattling at the back door. You don't want to know how. You do have to worry about the right things. The most pressing worries may be right underfoot, like the snake. But in this interconnected world, security threats to people in faraway places have a way of migrating. We think of our country's borders as electric fences surrounded by guard towers and moats. But in reality, our borders are more illusory, rather like the parallel white lines ranchers sometimes paint across roads to keep the cattle from roaming too far. To a cow, the trompe-d'oeil white lines look like a grate into which they might slip, and they avoid them. But more determined animals trudge right over these supposed barriers. The reports we've been listening to this hour present us with an airport international arrivals board no one would want to see. Now arriving gate 23D, AIDS or SARS from Asia. Smuggled guns from Colombia at the B gate. Violent insurgency in Uganda, fostering terrorism not far behind. Nuclear material inbound from Russia. We do instinctively share some of the security concerns of people in far-flung corners of the world. Polls last fall showed American voters making the connection between the terrible Chechen terrorist school takeover in southern Russia late last summer and their choice for U.S. president 3 months later. Yet fear itself is not a policy to live by. What is more useful is the understanding that when more people feel secure where they live, the safer the world becomes for Ugandans, Colombians, Thais, Russians, and Americans. For Security Check, confronting today's global threats, I'm David Brancaccio.
Security Check, Confronting Today's Global Threats, was produced by Simon Marks, Kristen McHugh, and Keith Porter. The sound engineer is Rima Snyder of Red Wagon Audio. We want to thank the Department of Homeland Security, the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority, Ken Mills, Larry Josephson, Robert Auld, and the Radio Foundation, the staff of Feature Story News, and Wink Music. For more information about Security Check, or to share your thoughts about this program, visit our website at globalsecuritycheck.org. Security Check, Confronting Today's Global Threats, is a production of the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio. More information about the Stanley Foundation is available on the web at stanleyfoundation.org.